This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
In The Human Motor, Energy, Fatigue, and the Origins of Modernity, Anson Rabinbach shows how, after 1870, the religious and moral discourse against acedia or sloth was taken up and replaced by the burgeoning scientific study of fatigue. Fatigue, Rabinbach argued, was considered both a physical and moral disorder. It replaced the traditional emphasis on idleness as the paramount cause of resistance to work. Its ubiquity was evidence of the body's stubborn subversion of modernity. Yeah, in this Bosch picture, sloth is, you can see it at about 1 o'clock. You see the slothful character sort of slumped in his chair in front of a nice warm fire on a plumped-up cushion, and a nun is trying to, you know, hoist on him a rosary and the Bible, and he's, you know, sleeping and takes no notice. But in the 18th century, that kind of vision of sloth has changed. Here's a Hogarth picture. You see how sloth is now idleness, and it's transposed. It's opposed to industry. You see Tom Idle at the front there. He's an apprentice. And, well, maybe we'll fast forward as we're a bit short of time. But you see the religious aspects of this. You see the good apprentice in church, the bad apprentice outside, fooling around. Next slide. The bad apprentice with his whore and eventually going to the gallows. In the 19th century, fatigue was considered a similar failure. It represented the refusal of the body and the mind to keep up with the demands of modern industrial labour. Maurice Keim, the French author of one of the first of these new textbooks on fatigue, after the 1870s, wrote that we flee it by instinct. It is responsible for our sloth and makes us desire inaction. And in 1904, the Heidelberg chemist Wilhelm Weikart announced the sensational news that he discovered a vaccine against fatigue. And he promised a utopia in which men would be able to work without ever growing weary and be fully available, like tireless machines, to profitable labour. In a legendary experiment, the Italian physiologist Angelo Masso, who invented the ergograph, this machine here, which was used to measure fatigue and to plumb the laws of the muscular spasms it induced, injected the blood of an old and exhausted dog into one that was rested. And he thought that the toxins in the blood acted as an immediate fatigue-inducing poison. This rested dog apparently showed all the symptoms of fatigue. And Weikart, impressed by this experiment, harvested a concentrated version of this venom from the blood of rats that he drove to death through exhaustion. He noticed that they descended into a kind of narcosis or stupor before... You know, they died, and he would be drawing their blood as they were in this, almost drug state. And he thought he'd developed an antibody from rats that proved immune to these toxins, and he called this miracle drug, a kind of cure for idleness, antikinotoxin. And in the decade following its invention, antikinotoxin vapors were pumped into Berlin's classrooms, in the hope that science could save school children from developing the dangerous seeds of sloth. The experiment was thought to be incredibly beneficial in curing laziness, and students who had been exposed to the gas secretly for 5 hours apparently performed with considerable improvement in their tests. Calculation increased by 50%, and the answers were much improved. And pupils who were usually sleepy and bored by the time of their afternoon lessons were uncharacteristically sprightly. But obviously, you know, this doesn't work. We've been pumping antikinotoxin into this auditorium for the past 5 hours. Yeah, and in 1914, on the eve of the war, when Austro-Hungarian army thought that antikinotoxin was going to provide them with a secret weapon to help them, to give them military advantage, there were a battery of independent scientific tests on the drug conducted on soldiers who received injections of antikinotoxin. And apparently they performed no better than those that had achieved injections of placebo. And in fact, other nerve whips, as they were called, such as caffeine and cocaine, unsurprisingly, proved much more effective. But even these stimulants only served to mask fatigue rather than to cure it. And absolute exhaustion inevitably set in. The war was fought on other technological fronts, but after the ceasefire, the search for a fatigue vaccine continued in the dismantled and humbled Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the blood was still thought to be the key to curing fatigue and expanding the limits, the horizons of human usefulness. But the emphasis was now on the hormones that flooded it, rather than the toxins that polluted it. A professor of experimental medicine at the Sorbonne, Charles-Edouard Brown-Séquard, brought attention to the chemical cues in the blood stream. He discovered that the loss of certain endocrine glands, such as the adrenal glands, caused death. And in the late 1880s, he started injecting himself with the juice of pulped guinea pig and dog testicles, a hormonal fluid that he believed cured his fatigue and rejuvenated him. And news of his elixir was widely publicised, the scientist enthusiastically took to the podium to tell everyone that he felt 30 years younger. He was able to work into the night. He was able to walk up the stairs without holding onto the banisters. And he added, his bowel movements were much improved. And 3 decades after these injections of testicular juices, there was a crave for rejuvenation or reactivation, as the rejuvenators preferred it to be known. In June 1922, a journalist for the New York Times wrote about this craze for rejuvenation. A war-ridden world has given way to a gland-ridden world. Nearly every newspaper and magazine that one picks up contains some reference, jocular or serious, to monkey glands and goat glands and the beneficent possibilities in human gland nurture and repair. The physiologist Serge Voronoff, a Russian working in Paris, thought that the rundown and aging could be revitalized by testicular transplants, which took over from the injections as the preferred sort of fatigue vaccine of choice. It was an operation pioneered by a doctor in Chicago who apparently performed the first ever procedure on himself, which he should deserve some prizes for. And many wealthy men underwent the surgery. Voronoff transplanted the testicles of executed criminals into millionaires. And apparently donors were in such short supply that there was what one scientist called a despicable trade in organs. Apparently lawyers would draw up contracts for these exchanges of testicles. And according to one newspaper, people were being mugged. I quote, knocked unconscious and then robbed of the long-sought-for organs. Voronoff solved this crisis by slicing and grafting the testicles of monkeys onto those of the wealthy men who sought his treatment. And there he is with his little penknife in front of the monkey enclosure, and you can see the monkeys going crazy. There he is with the first ever chimpanzee to donate his testicles to one of Voronoff's wealthy patients. And Voronoff said whoever acquired these monkey glands would be able to work longer. You know, work is the sort of key thing here. Have improved memories, eyesight, and another key factor, improved sex drive. And he set up a special breeding center for chimpanzees on the Italian Riviera, which was run by a former circus animal keeper. And the monkeys were apparently uncorrupted by the debilitating effects of fatigue on civilization. What Voronoff promised was spurious. Animal grafts wouldn't have taken, but the scarring that these men had implied that they had been absorbed. But the idea that one might be made younger or more virile by apes, a kind of evolutionary trick, according to one journalist, seeped into the popular mind like water into sand. For the mind of man has thirsted for the secret for untold centuries. And Voronoff became extremely wealthy from his grafts, and he occupied the entire first floor of one of Paris's most expensive hotels, and he was surrounded by chauffeurs, valets, personal secretaries, and two mistresses. If the body was a machine, its energy quickly sapped by the demands of modernity, it was thought that you could revive it by replacing or augmenting its exhausted batteries, in this case, the testicles. You know, it was like putting in two more AA batteries into the body. And one doctor in America who apparently did 12,000 injections of goat gland extracts into people between the ages of 52 and 76 in the 1920s in America, claiming in the process to have revived the living dead, explained to an audience in New York, "The human body was just like a storage battery of a motor car or radio whose potency ebbs with use and needs to be reinvigorated at certain intervals to restore its customary vitality." In Vienna, Eugen Steinach also performed... Oh, sorry, this is one of Voronoff's patients. If you go back one. That patient's father kindly donated his testicles, and you can see the miraculous difference that this boy underwent. Next slide. This is Steinach. He was director of the Biological Institute in Vienna, and he was nominated for the Nobel Prize 6 times in the 20s and 30s. And he thought he could cure homosexuality by these testicular transplants. He would take the testicle from a supposedly normal man, swap it for a homosexual's, and this was supposed to straighten them out. But he came up with an ingenious... Obviously, that didn't work, but he claimed miraculous results. But he came up with this ingenious solution to the shortage of testicles for transplants and grafts, which was the vasectomy. Rather than the patient's own glands would be re-stimulated, he thought, into activity by the vasectomy. And the theory behind this was that there were sperm-producing cells in the testicles and also Leydig cells, which produced hormones. And if you underwent a vasectomy, there would be more room for these Leydig cells to flood the body with hormones, because the sperm-producing cells would atrophy away. This became extremely faddish operation to have in the 1920s. And both Sigmund Freud and W.B. Yeats underwent the operation, and both claimed that it had some success on them. They were both in their late 60s. Freud had it to cure to stay cancer that he suffered in his jaw. And he told the scientist Harry Benjamin, who performed a lot of these operations in America and in New York especially, that it had had a great effect on him. Where in later life he corrected this view. And Yeats also said that after his operation, his creativity had increased and his sex drive had also been fully restored. And Norman Hare, the scientist who performed the vasectomy in Harley Street in London, apparently invited Yeats to dinner with this young girl who was going to test his renewed sex drive. And apparently it was much improved. The first of Steinach's vasectomies was performed on a 43-year-old coachman suffering from chronic fatigue. This isn't actually him, but these are the kind of testimonial pictures that accompanied Steinach's book on rejuvenation. And the first people that underwent the procedure did so without their permission. So the first patient presented himself. He had the appearance of an exhausted and prematurely old man, Steinach reported in his book, Rejuvenation Through Experimental Regeneration of the Aging Interstitial Gland. And then a year after the operation, his skin appeared soft with fine down, pliable and moist. He had to shave twice as often as he had before. He could now drag heavy loads of 220 pounds. He says, about 18 months after the vasculature ligature, this man with his smooth, unwrinkled face, his smart and upright bearing, gives the impression of a man at the height of his vitality. And Stanek made a film of these people who had undergone the procedure, and apparently it was sold out in Vienna. There was a medical and popular version, and in the popular version, people would sort of queue around the block to go and see it. And it showed not only these men that underwent complete metamorphosis, but also the rats that he had operated on, giving a scientific legitimacy in the kind of laboratory. These old rats who could hardly walk were shown, you know, suddenly sprightly and playful, and then finally surrounded by loads of more rats, their offspring. And the New York Times reported in 1920s that there was a mass exodus of scientists to Vienna going to learn this new technique. And the secret, they said, of acquiring these techniques at a great distance added to the expensive fees that these doctors could charge. One of them, Alfred Wilson, apparently paid £700 for his operation in the 1920s, quite a sizable amount. He was due to give a talk at the Albert Hall on how I was made younger by the method of Professor Steinach. But unfortunately, he died that morning, which wasn't great for the testimonial benefits. But his friend said that he died due to excitement and overexertion. And Norman Hare, who performed Yates's Steinach operation, said that he had been warned not to be too prodigal of his newfound strength, but forgot that he was in his 70s and tried to live like a young man in his 20s. The result, of course, was disaster. The vasectomy was originated in the 1890s as a non-traumatic version of castration, which was then used to treat enlarged prostates. And one castrated patient apparently murdered his surgeon. He was so furious at being emasculated. So there was this search for a new treatment. And the first vasectomy done for non-medical reasons was done by Harry Sharp in 1899 on a 19-year-old boy at an Indiana school who indulged in excessive masturbation, itself a long-recognized byproduct of the sin of sloth. The boy, according to Sharp, after his vasectomy, became more of a sunny disposition, brighter of intellect, and ceased to masturbate. And by 1907, when the first Eugenic Act passed in Sharp's home state of Indiana, he'd operated on 176 other masturbating minors. And the patients all improved mentally and physically, apparently, in that they increase in flesh, feel that they are stronger, sleep better, their memory improves, the will becomes stronger, and their school progress advances. And by 1937, 32 states were performing eugenic sterilizations on criminals, the unfit, and the insane. But what interests me about the Steinach operation was that these eugenic techniques were used on the very people who were supposed to be improving the racial makeup of the species. Benjamin claimed that the Steinach operation would increase the productive yield of great men, scientists, inventors, artists, you know, people like Freud and Yates. And the American novelist Gertrude Atherton, who was incredibly prolific, she wrote about 60 novels, and she published one in the 1920s called Black Oxen, which was based on her experience of the female equivalent of the Steinach operation, which involved x-raying the ovaries, and she claimed that it had a transforming effect on her. Her brain, she said, seemed sparkling with light after the procedure. And she went on a book tour to Germany in the 1920s and 1924, and she suggested that Germany, whose best young men had been lost in the war, make herself predominant again by having, quote, her supermen subjected to the Steinach treatment and rejuvenated. So the vasectomy was not only linked to sterilization, but linked to eugenic sterilization, but to improvement, to national regeneration. And the Nazis ridiculed this idea at the time. mockingly suggesting that they should establish a ministry to judge who was worthy of the Steinach operation or not. But they were obviously enthusiasts of the vasectomy. And in the Third Reich, it's estimated that 1 million vasectomies were performed. The Steinach operation as a cure for fatigue was killed off finally in the mid-1930s when scientists managed to isolate testosterone. And synthetic testosterone provided a simpler, quicker, and much more certain method of increasing the hormone. And the Steinach operation, its earlier success was attributed to the placebo effect. Unfortunately, those wishing for renewed youth suffer inordinately from the will to believe, wrote one doctor in the Journal of the American Medical Association. The LA Times, whose proprietor had the famous Brinkley goat gland injections, he was one of the most famous glandular quacks in America. You can see people having, you can see the goats and the goat glands being transplanted. They reported in the mid-1930s, when this fad of curing fatigue was on the wane, that the sensational miracles promised by yarns in the Sunday supplements failed to materialize. After all, they said, people who live fast should expect to die young.